Hi everyone, I'm so excited about today's episode of Beauty Bosses. I get the pleasure of speaking with my friend, Elizabeth Kerpis. Welcome.
Thank you for having me.
I'm so happy to have you. Elizabeth is not only an amazing fashion lawyer, but she is also an editor at large for Daily Front Row. So we have so much to talk about because it's New York Fashion Week right now.
That is true. Yes, it is.
First, let's have you explain a little bit to everyone about what a fashion lawyer is.
Sure. So how I work is I am like an outside general counsel to my clients. So a lot of the, you know, larger brands have lawyers that work inside their company and their employees, but some of the mid-sized brands and startup brands don't have sort of the funds to resources to have an in-house counsel. So they hire me as someone who works like their general counsel, but I am on an hourly basis or a retainer basis. So I handle anything legal that comes their way. And I work on what I can work on. And if I can't, I then hire outside counsel to manage the deal, and I'll manage those people. So it's really a sort of a niche market, but one that smaller companies and mid-sized companies find very beneficial.
Do you feel like it helps you personally and professionally that you have a personal interest in fashion? Because I love your style. You always look so chic and put together. Do you think it helps you speak to your clients more?
I think absolutely, because I think the fashion industry is so nuanced that if you don't sort of have that passion for it and you're not really paying attention to the nitty-gritty details, it makes the job a little more difficult. So, for instance, a lot of my clients come to me as a result of working with other lawyers where their specialty might be something more generalized and less focused on fashion, and they don't quite issue spot the same way and find some of the bigger things that might come up in a contract or a hole in the contract or hypothetical scenarios that can come up that I recognize because I've seen it happen. Or experienced it with other clients and things like that.
Yeah, I think that's very cool because sometimes the things that historically have pigeonholed women, especially in professional fields, can end up becoming an advantage.
Exactly.
Like, I think understanding fashion, the feminine gaze, how fashion works in real life can be such a huge win for your clients.
Well, it's really interesting because the firm that I was at last before I started on my own had a sports law practice, and there's obviously no body of sport or no body of law that governs sports, right? And so I thought, well, that's just more of a marketing thing, and it's sort of an umbrella term of sports law. So why can't we do that for fashion? Because that's sort of, not to stereotype, but sort of the female version of sports, right? Totally. And so, and in a big law firm, you already have tons of fashion clients, so it sort of made sense to be able to market that towards existing clients. And again, it's like a very nuanced thing, but it was sort of unheard of. And at the time, people looked at me sort of sideways, but I managed to sort of squeak it through at my firm. And then when I went out on my own, it just made more sense to focus on that only. So
I love it also because as a fashionable person and a fashion lawyer and someone who, you know, loves beautiful things, you really are walking the walk and talking the talk. But not only that, I think there is this extent to which women of our generation grew up being told that you could either be a person of substance or a superficial, like, kind of fashion beauty junkie. And the idea that we don't have to dichotomize ourselves into either or, and you can be all the things, is freeing.
No, it is very freeing. And actually, just to see the evolution, because when I was in law school, I knew I wanted to focus on some sort of fashion field in the legal field, but the only thing available was probably taking like an IP, intellectual property course, or internet law. That was the closest you could get to it. Now, all the law schools have fashion programs. Even Fordham Law School has like a specialty in fashion. And I have so many students that are in law school now that reach out to me. They're like, I want to be a fashion lawyer. What do? Can I shadow you? You know, all those sorts of things. And that just was not a thing. So I saw it from nothing to sort of its infancy to now where it's a growing field that in 10 years from now, there will be practices in large firms called the fashion law practice. I think it's going to be more ubiquitous.
Absolutely. Fashion is a $1 trillion industry.
Exactly.
This is like the real life legally blonde.
Right, exactly. And it was a huge hole in the market. And it's funny because I think a lot of the partners when I was in big law just didn't see it that way. They kind of, again, looked at it how you were saying, sort of a frivolous thing, or what are you talking about? I'm like, the fashion world is like a multi-trillion dollar industry. Like, we are not marketing towards this. We can market towards existing clients, new clients. It's drumming up business, cross-promoting. It was just, to me, it was so obvious. And well, sometimes those industries are a little slow in the uptake, but...
Yeah, but they get there.
They get there eventually.
People like you help show them the light.
Show them the way. Exactly.
Okay, I want to talk to you about some topics in fashion law, because I think this is such an interesting field. So the first thing I wanted to ask you about is the tricky realm of copyright and intellectual property in fashion.
Okay.
So I've heard so many different things about, you know, can Chanel own the camellia?
Right.
Can Louboutin own the red sole?
Right.
And so could you speak to us a little bit about how fashion brands in either some of these famous iconic cases or more generally how they handle this topic?
Yeah, it's really, really tricky. So the problem with the fashion industry as a whole is that there's not a ton of IP protections available. So you can sit there and you can design a dress and someone can take the exact same dress, so like a fast fashion type of situation, and copy the thing and there's nothing you can do about it. There are certain protections. So one would be you can copyright a print. So if you have a original print that you design, let's say you're a painter, you paint it, you make it into a fabric, you can copyright that. So if somebody then knocks off your dress, they're selling it on Amazon, you could at least get them to take that down. Or the photographs, for instance. So I had a client recently whose jewelry was knocked off. And it was sold on Alibaba or AliExpress, one of those, and we saw it on a jewelry company out west, but they bought it independent. They didn't realize what they were doing, and it was an issue, but because they used the photos that they took, we have copyrights on those photos, right? And so could they have stolen designs outright? Absolutely. There's nothing you can do about that. But because they happened to take the photos as well, we were able to get those taken down.
And it has such far-reaching implications, right? Because not only have we seen the emergence of dupe culture and the ultra-accurate bag replicas and the, you know, the Cartier love bracelet that can't have a valuation any longer because you can't prove that it's real. But you see this trickling to everywhere.
Everywhere. And you also have to differentiate, and some people don't realize there's a difference between knockoffs and counterfeits, right? So a knockoff would be like taking the love bracelet, looks identical, but you're not calling it a Cartier bracelet. Whereas a counterfeit is taking the exact same thing and writing Cartier on it and saying this is a Cartier bracelet, right? So those are two sort of completely different things. So it really depends, but we, you know, we try to do as much as we can do as far as protections and putting them in place, but you can only take that so far, unfortunately.
I think one of the things that frustrates designers and creatives is that the research and development stage, if you will, and all of the creativity and the work behind the scenes that goes into the final iteration of the wrap dress, the, you know, the Burberry trench, like these iconic designs that you can recognize from a mile away, all of the stuff that goes into it gets knocked off in 1 second. So you sort of short circuit the progress.
Yeah, it's tricky. I think it's probably a big ego blow. And, you know, whether or not it's a blow to the purse, I don't know, because you have to think if someone's buying, let's say, Celine, and the person that's buying the $100, you know, knockoff, I don't know, would they be buying the Celine, you know, the real one? I don't know, right? And so I think that's sort of the ultimate debate. And I think that at this point, particularly because how fast fashion has sort of taken over sort of the contemporary level that's being sort of eaten alive right now by fast fashion, you have the high end, that people just see as sort of the cost of doing business. And you have to kind of accept and know that it's going to happen. And there's not a ton you can do about it to stop it. So
yeah, and I guess the big brands at the forefront of innovation have to innovate some more. You have to stay three steps ahead of your competition.
Right.
So the knockoffs are last year's product, not this year's.
Right.
Which is so interesting.
Very interesting.
What do you think about what I see as this sort of beigeification of fashion, where across the board with some of these trends, like the sort of quiet luxury aesthetic trend, we see a lot more brands becoming more similar to each other in work product. And I know we always will have what's on the runway, we'll always have couture, but do you think that this is a consumer problem, or do you think this is like a fashion brand problem? Or how do we think about these trends?
I mean, is it a problem?
Is it a problem? Maybe it's not. Maybe it's a solution.
Maybe it's a solution.
We should go back to the factory workwear, and then we'll all be the same.
Well, here's the thing, too, and this is just my personal opinion. It's not based on anything. But I also think that you can notice craftsmanship and quality much better when things are sort of simpler. Like, I think there's been a sort of a sensory overload since COVID happened with, you know, the cottagecore and pattern and embellishment and all these things. And we're kind of just bringing things back to being more simplistic. And there's something refreshing about that, to me, at least, and monochromatic, and it's sort of more calming in a way. So hopefully we're sort of entering an era of things being a little more peaceful. I don't know.
Yeah, maybe understated and subtle. Exactly. I love that. Yeah, in my work, we always think about light and shadows, form, balance, harmony. And right. I think those are some of the same themes that we see in fashion, where at the end of the day, you can make a well-cut paper bag into something that looks really cute.
Right. I mean, look at Balenciaga, what they sell. They'll sell you an IKEA bag if they can. Right?
They probably have.
Yeah, exactly.
I vaguely recall.
I know, exactly. You know, that's what I'm saying. I think that was like a thing for a minute. So you never know. But I don't know, I do think, though, that you know, quality and craftsmanship is more obvious when things are a little simpler. You know, you can see the stitching better, and if something's knocked off, it's obvious. If there's a pucker in the seam, it's a little more obvious. So, I don't know, hopefully that differentiates between the high and the low, and there's something for everyone out there.
What should a designer do if they don't want their goods to be knocked off? Is there anything to do?
No, because, you know, at the end of the day, you can have your factories, maybe, and it depends where you produce, have them sign, you know, NDAs, but that's not going to stop them from even producing themselves, right? I mean, that's sort of a tale as old as time, as far as factories kind of producing the goods off-label, but it's the same exact coat, right? You can go the Max Mara or something like that, and I bet you there's coats coming out of the factories that are the same coats, but
yeah, there
the
was
labels,
that big controversy,
right?
When the Restoration Hardware factory started like making everybody their dupe cloud couches.
That's my,
for
that's
pennies
exactly.
on the dollar.
I think consumers, if they really knew sort of how these factories worked and how, you know, the back end works a bit, they'd be surprised. So it's really kind of interesting. I think that, like I said, you can do what you can do, or you can have some sort of non-compete provision. But again, if let's say you're dealing with a factory in China, have fun enforcing that. I mean, it would be a logistical and monetary nightmare, right? And they know that. So
people just keep it moving.
Yeah. Well, I think it's one of those things that just, it's a write-off at that point.
We see that in every realm, right? Mm-hmm. People were trying to reverse engineer Coca-Cola,
right.
Skincare. We have competitors all the time who try to do gas chromatography and figure out our formulations and recreate them. It's like, it's wild out there.
Right.
You got to stay current. There's no answer. You have to just keep moving.
Right. But at least with something like a product, you could at least patent it. Right.
Yes.
And so you'd have that, and that's legitimate, you know, protection. Whereas fashion, it's a little less. It's more like a round peg in a square hole. So.
Yeah. Unfortunately, with medical grade skincare, the best formulations and ingredients are in the realm of science, public information.
Oh, interesting.
And so, you know, sometimes a delivery mechanism can be patentable, but the concepts of...
It's out there.
Yeah, it's out there.
Yeah.
It's out there.
Oh, interesting. See, it shows what I know about beauty. But.
Yeah.
Or patents. Patent is not my specialty, okay? So.
Okay, so there's so many other topics. So the other thing I wanted to talk to you about was the rise of fast fashion.
Yep.
And there's so many legal controversies around this because people debate working conditions, the sort of the ethics of it all. Do you find a place in your life and wardrobe for both the high and the low? And what is fast fashion doing? Is it helping us and democratizing fashion to everybody, or is it hurting us because it's creating unfair work conditions and knocking off the big designers?
I think the arguments can go in 100 different directions with this. I think this is probably a topic in of itself. Generally speaking, I'm not a big fast fashion person myself, but I do like sort of, you know, I think there's a lot of smaller brands out there that, like this, for instance, is a brand called Align out of England, out of London, and their price points are almost like fast fashion price points, but they're small batch. And I think that like COS and Cezanne and some of these newer companies, their model is different. So rather than doing sort of large quantities of lower end clothing, they do very small batches with a lot of drops. And I think then by doing that, it allows you to kind of go to different types of factories that maybe are smaller and don't have the capability of producing in large quantities, but they have safeguards in places for safety or sustainability, or their supply chain is sort of diligently combed through to make sure that, you know, there's certain, you know, maybe hazardous working in conditions that wouldn't be, you know, applicable to their factory.
Yeah. I think we're also seeing lately the rise of so many collaborations in fashion, which I think is interesting because from an intellectual property standpoint, you're taking two totally different vibes, aesthetics, core audiences, and bringing them together. So are there some examples of fashion collaborations you've seen that are innovative or interesting?
Yeah, I mean, I think they all are. I think, you know, collaborations have been going on for a while now, but what's interesting in the last few years is the collaborations that come together that you wouldn't think would come together. And so I know, you know, everybody has seen like the North Facing Gucci, and that's, you know, you'd think traditionally, like, why would Gucci ever collaborate with North Face? Because they make jackets themselves and make coats themselves. And traditionally, that's not something you would do. You would collaborate with a brand that produces something that you don't produce, and in an effort to move into a separate channel or a market that you're not necessarily producing in, right? So if, you know, a shoe company collaborates with a jewelry company, well, they don't have jewelry customers. So for them, that might be, you know, a nice entree for customer acquisition for them. So it's interesting to kind of see these iconic brands in their own rights come together but have overlap. So I think that's really interesting, and we're seeing more of that, and that's trickling down to smaller brands too.
Yeah, it's been interesting also to see that in the marriage of art and fashion, like the Murakami LVMH collection, which was one of their most successful collections of all time.
Right.
And really brought some modern art to the masses.
Absolutely.
Like, everybody knows that LV logo, but it's not everyone knew the iconic. I mean, now they do.
Yeah.
Do you have any predictions about the future of fashion? What do you think is going to happen next in this big industry?
I mean, it's hard to say. I mean, I think AI is going to change things a lot. I think it's one of those things. I think it's going to be the next revolution insofar as how the internet was for us, right? Like, one day there was just the internet, and then it evolved into something that our minds couldn't have possibly gotten around 20 years ago. We could not have figured out that we'd be where we are today. So I think AI is going to do things for the fashion industry that we've just never seen before and probably can't contemplate today, right? I think the way we shop might be different. I mean, who knows, right? We might be able to, you know, virtually shop with ourselves, walking through stores and trying things on, and you just sort of don't know. But I think that that's going to be something that 20 years from now, we'll be like, how did we even sort of survive
without your
virtual
avatar doing the virtual try-on in your inbox?
Well, it's interesting too, and I saw a video on YouTube recently, and I never really thought about it. They, you know, the difference between, let's say, AI and like even Google when you're searching something. So you put something in a search box in Google, and you get, let's say, 100 million hits of something to explain a concept, or you know, you could 100 articles you can read about, and then you can formulate your own opinion or decision or whatever it is based on the research that you find. Whereas AI is one answer. Right? You put in whatever you put in, the question is, and it's in theory, you know, putting all these different resources together and coming up with an answer. And who's coming up with that answer, right? A computer, the programmers, where is that coming from? But now you're no longer sort of given that opportunity to look at, you know, a million different resources and make that decision yourself. You're having a computer sort of make that decision or that, you know, make that opinion for you. So it's really interesting, and I don't know how that's going to kind of play out.
It's so interesting. To me, I see AI as a resource, as a secondary source. It's not a primary source.
No.
It's just a regurgitation, a very effective, very fast, articulate, interesting regurgitation of what's already out there. But in terms of pushing the envelope of creativity, that's like a huge missing piece.
Right.
And I think we're seeing this with, you know, there was this joke when I was in my residency that one of the august surgeons, who shall remain nameless, got a 7 out of 10, 10 out of 10 times, which is like not great, not a great review. But I feel that way about AI, where ChatGPT gets a solid 7 out of 10, 10 out of 10 times.
Well, I think it's a good starting point. Fail. It's a good starting point, I think. I don't, you know, it's not something that, at least at this point, that we can rely on, right? But, you know, and that's for maybe something like, I wouldn't rely on it for a research paper, right? But in fashion, I don't know how that's going to play out, right? What if someone's just relies on it saying, okay, show me the, you know, best top five black dresses that sold this year. And that's what I, you know,
that's
now
so
can you
valuable.
Manipulate those results? Like who's making that decision? Where are they gathering that information from? What are they basing it on? Because what if, you know, your top five dresses, maybe you shop at Prada and you shop at Gucci and you don't want to look at anything else. But what about the person that's shopping at the Zara's and they're shopping at the H&M's, right? I don't know sort of how that's going to play out, but I think it's going to be an important sort of like how Google is, like how we rely on Google. I think it's going to be that we're going to be that reliant on it.
Yeah, well, so it's going to be up to our generation, because I was reading this fun article about how we're digitally native, but we grew up with one foot in analog world. So right. we're translating to the next generation, the last generation, and bridging them. So really hopefully we'll figure it out.
I know. I mean, the whole thing's interesting. And even just the way fashion sort of comes back around is really interesting to me. So I was, right before I came here, I stopped in the Prada store. And the sneakers they have for sale, I have the exact same sneakers from 25 years ago. And I'm like, the same ones. And I sent a picture to my husband because he had them too. And we both still have them. And we haven't worn them probably for 20 years. But, and I said, they're $900 now. Except when we bought them, they were probably like $250. But the same exact sneakers. So it's just interesting too. I think a lot of these brands that had iconic styles from like the, you know, late 90s, early 2000s, they don't have to do anything. They can just reproduce what they made then.
Yeah. And there's sort of like a cyclical pattern, maybe a 30-year
But it's exact. Lifespan. That's what's kind of crazy. Like, I feel like there's always a cyclical pattern, right? Like, think about, you know, bell bottoms or flare jeans, and that comes back every, let's say, 15, 20 years.
I know. But hello to the boot cut.
The boot cut. I mean, I saw that and I was like, I want those jeans.
Listen,
I have boot cut jeans now.
I'm staying true to the skinny jeans and the side parting, and I'm just, I think like 2 more years and I'm going to be completely back on trend.
Yeah, it's fine.
It's fine, right?
It's fine.
Okay, my last question is about how fashion is personally integrated into your life. Do you feel like fashion changes the way you carry yourself, the way you look at yourself, your identity, your confidence? And do you think that fashion is an important part of our lives, or do you think we really should go back to the school uniforms?
Listen, I'm all for the school uniform.
I love that my kids wear the same thing every day.
No, it's the best. It's the best. And I think it probably saves a lot of relationships too, having to, you know, the morning arguments of whether you can wear something or not wear something, or, you know.
Yeah.
I mean, I think I love fashion. I wouldn't consider myself someone who's like been obsessed with fashion my whole life. I do like to dress up. But that's just me, right? Like, I'm not comfortable walking around in sweatpants on the street or leggings. That's just not who I am. I like being dressed. Like, I love being in a ball gown. Like, I feel my best. I feel beautiful. I feel comfortable. So I think it really depends on whatever makes you comfortable and what you like, right? And so, but that's where my comfort zone is personally.
How do you integrate all of this into your role at the Daily Front Row? Because you're an editor at large.
Yep.
And tell us a little bit about what you're doing there.
Well, it's funny because I feel like a lot of like lawyers are, you know, lack creativity. And I pride myself on sort of being very creative, but also you're very type A and, you know, that sort of thing. And the law itself is very literal. And so I need a creative outlet. And so I've always sort of sought out opportunities to write. So, you know, I've written for Quest for, gosh, probably like 12, 13 years now as a contributing writer there. So when the Daily Front Row approached me about being the editor at large there, I mean, to me, it was just such a perfect sort of marriage between what I do and what I, you know, like to do on the side, right? And so a lot of my clients are in the Daily, you know, I get clients from working at the Daily. So there's a lot of synergy there and they really complement one another.
All right. And final question. Yeah. A little piece of advice for somebody who's listening to this who thinks that maybe this is their future or they may want to do something like this.
Yeah, it's interesting because, like I said earlier, that the law schools now have so many more programs and things available to you. And there's trends if you want to go in-house, let's say, to be a lawyer at one of the big fashion companies or any of them, really, of the type of lawyers they're looking to hire. So like for a while it was privacy, now it's, you know, AI or employment. There's certain areas of law that you can focus on, even if you don't get there right away, that will eventually get you there. So like I said, employment's one of those, if you focus on that, or any corporate transactions, things like that, IP obviously. So there's like, if you, I would say go on any of these sites, these job, like a LinkedIn type place, or, you know, where they have job listings, and see what a lot of the job applications, what they're looking for, because it'll give you an idea of where the market is and how it's moving and what you should be focusing on.
All right. Thanks, Elizabeth. This was so fun.
It was so fun.
Take care.
Well, thank you for having me.
All right.